or PET for short. So I'm going to be saying PET a lot. And so I'm going to give you some introduction, some overview of the applications, and then hopefully we'll have time to do the spatial analysis, which is what I've been working on, which is part of my master's thesis. So, okay, so let's get started. So medical imaging, so what is it? Medical physics, what is it? So I went to Google Wikipedia, and here is the definition that they give. Medical physics is a division of healthcare science concerning the applications of physics to medicine. It generally concerns physics as applied to medical imaging and radiotherapy. So those are the two big branches of medical physics, imaging and radiotherapy. And what I'm going to be talking about is imaging. There's going to be a talk about radiotherapy later on. So medical imaging is a technique and process used to create images of the human body in parts or function thereof for clinical purposes or medical science. So basically what that means is if we want to know if there's something wrong with you, we would like to take a picture of you. We would like to see inside of you, because otherwise we would have to kill you if we wanted to see inside you otherwise. So we want to try to find ways of imaging your body while you're alive. Basically. So now, I'm sure you have all heard of some of these, at least. So these are all the kinds of medical imagings that are available. X-rays, I'm sure everybody has had X-rays taken, fluoroscopy, mammography, X-ray computed tomography, which is now called CT, and it used to be called CAT, and ultrasound, MRI, PET, which is what we're going to learn about today, single photon emission computed tomography, magnetoencephalography, electroencephalography, etc. Anyways, there's a lot of imaging. And one of the cool things about it is that if you, for example, are trying to do an assignment on CAT scans and you type CAT scans into Google, it gives you like something like that. And that gives me lots of ideas for what I could do with my cat that I haven't tried to do that yet. So, okay, so now, out of all these imaging techniques, they all do something different. They are all useful for different things. So what I'm going to talk about is PET. So what does PET do? So here's a little overview of what it actually is. So what we do is we inject radioactive substances into people's bodies. These radioactive substances are going to go to different parts of your body, and they're going to emit light, and then we're going to detect that light using scanners like that one. So, yes, so you did hear right, we inject radioactive substances into people. But they are very, very small amounts of radioactivity. It's of course, it's safe, otherwise we wouldn't do it. You have to go through ethics approvals and everything to do that. And so here's an example of someone getting injected with one of those tracers. And if you can see the syringe here, it's got a metal, it's got a lead lining on it, because there's the technicians who handle this, right? And they're doing this every day, so you need to protect them. Radiation protection is a big part of PET. So that's basically what happens. Now, what kind of radioactive substances do we use, or what kind of radioactive isotopes do we use? Well, so like the name says, so the P in PET is for positron. So what you use is you use isotopes that will decay, so unstable isotopes that will decay by emitting a positron. So that positron is gonna travel inside your body until it meets an electron, and they're gonna do what they always do, which is annihilate. And they're going to give off two photons of 511 keV each, traveling in almost exactly opposite directions. So you have two photons coming out, and you know what energies, and you know they're going to be more or less 180 degrees apart. So here's an example. Here's some examples of the most widely used PET isotopes. So for example, carbon-11, it's going to travel the electron. It's going to travel a maximum of about 4 millimeters inside your body, and the half-life of that isotope is 20 minutes. So you want something that is going to decay somewhat fast so that you don't stay, you know, radioactive for a few days and then you go home and you're radioactive. So you want something that stays radioactive for long enough that you can image, but not too long, so that, you know, you have to stay away from people for a while. And you also want something that is not going to travel. You want something that's going to emit positrons that don't travel very far, because that's going to blur your image, right? So, for example, oxygen. It could travel a maximum of 5.4 millimeters in your body. So that's going to give you some blurring already, right? So you're not going to know exactly where that photon came from within a 4-millimeter radius. So one of the most widely used is fluorine 18, because it has a really nice long but not too long half-life, and it has a nice and small range. So that's why we use it a lot. So we have these radioactive isotopes. So what do we put them in before we put them into people's bodies? We put them into substances that are already into your body. So for example, we put them inside molecules that already exist in your body so that it's not harmful to you. So here is an example of what the glucose molecule looks like. And glucose is used almost by every cell in your body. Glucose and sugars are the fuel of your cells. Basically, that's what your cells use to live and to do what they do, to reproduce. So almost everything in your body uses glucose. And it just so happens that the structure of glucose is such that you can attach a fluorine atom on it, and it's not going to disrupt the glucose molecule, but now this glucose molecule is going to emit radiation when you inject it into somebody. And then, so what you do is you put those radioactive substances inside people. You're going to put them in the PET scanner, and like I said, you know that if there is a positron being meeting an electron and annihilating, and they're going to give off two photons in opposite directions. If you detect one there and one there at exactly the same time, you know that it must have come from somewhere along here. And then if you detect another pair here and here also at the same time, and you trace a line, and they meet at one point, you know that there must be a lot of electrons, a lot of photons being given off in that direction. So that's where your tracer, that's where your radio tracer, that's where your substance is accumulating inside your body. So here's an example of an image of someone's brain. I know it doesn't look as... Really? Wow. Okay. I know it doesn't look as a high resolution as other ones, but that is someone's brain. So what do we use this for? So we use it to image all sorts of things. So here's an example of someone with cancer, unfortunately. But you see that here, before they start radiotherapy, there's a lot of glucose being taken up in this area over here, because cancers, they reproduce a lot, and they require a lot of energy to grow. So that's why they're taking up a lot of glucose. And after chemotherapy, it looks a lot more normal than before. And so these are 2D projections, but here's an example of a 3D image. So this is also glucose again. But like I said, it's 3D images. So it's really nice because it gives you a lot of information. And so what do we do with it? So what I do with it is I use it for brain imaging, to image people's brains. So for example, here's a picture of someone's brain, and this time we're not putting glucose into them, but we're putting something called fluoro L-DOPA. So what this substance does is simulates the neurotransmitter dopamine. And dopamine is used to regulate all sorts of things in your brain, including motivation, reward, learning, and movement. It's very important for you to move around. You need neurons that produce dopamine. So what do we use it for? So we use this fluoro L-DOPA. What we use it for is to study Parkinson's disease. Because in Parkinson's disease, what happens is those neurons that produce dopamine, they die. We don't know why, but they do. And so it affects the function of the brain, a lot of functions, but specifically motor control. So people who get Parkinson's disease, they shake a lot. They can control the shakes, and they have a hard time moving around. And I don't know if you know, but Michael J. Fox has Parkinson's, and he's actually a big donor for us. And he actually got it when he was quite young. It usually happens when you're older, but he got it when he was quite young. So we use PET to study Parkinson's disease because, as I said, so there's, again, the example of a healthy person. That's what someone with Parkinson's disease looks like. So you can see right away that the emission that should be over there for a healthy person is not there for them anymore. So that's usually what we use it for. So what usually happens in PET data is that you analyze, you take data over hours. So you take data over an hour or up to 4 hours, and you see how where it accumulates and how fast. So for example, in tumors, your glucose is going to accumulate very fast than in the so this is the accumulation over time. This is what a normal brain would look like. This is what a tumor looks like. So it picks up a lot of glucose very fast. So that's what happens. So you analyze the data over time, but we haven't been able to do spatial analysis of it yet. So you saw how the shape changed of those structures in the brain for someone with Parkinson's disease. We haven't been able to study the spatial characteristics of that yet, because it's hard to do, because people's brains are different. You know, someone's taller than someone else, and their brains also look different. So these two brains are to scale, basically. And so what you want to do is, you know, these are 3D data, and you want to find a way to describe 3D data where it doesn't matter how big these structures are and to what orientation they were in the scanner. So I'm going to cut to the punchline. And what we're using is something called moment invariance. So if you remember normal distributions, you know, they have a mean and they have a width to them, which is the variance or the standard deviation. So you can describe, you know, the shape. You can describe the shape by, you know, if it's skewed to one side or if it's skewed to the other side or if it's skinny or wide. So that's how you can describe it. Basically, that's what we're using to describe the spatial characteristics. And you can derive 3D combinations of those properties that are invariant no matter what orientation the shape is in. So here's an example. So here, if you idle the variances in all the directions, that should stay the same if you incline your head or if you tilt it back or if your shape stays small or large. So that's an example. And we used these to study PET data, and it turns out it works actually. So here are those moments, those characteristics. And for normal people, that's what their characteristics looks like. So they're low. These values are low, which means they're very symmetric. Like they're very symmetric all along, and there's emission coming from everywhere along that shape. But for PD patients, for people with Parkinson's disease, that's what it looks like. So it's very different. So it's a nice mathematical way to compare those to the spatial properties of those images. And you can also tell the difference as, you know, for people with very advanced Parkinson's disease, the shape changes a lot more than for people who are just starting with Parkinson's disease. So this is going to be very nice to help you trace as the disease gets worse, how much worse. And for example, if a pharmaceutical company says that they have a medicine that's going to help with Parkinson's disease, then we can take images after they start taking the medication and see if it's true. You know, if the shape of those structures in the brain go back to being what they were supposed to be like. So this is going to help us a lot from now on to be able to describe those characteristics. So that's it basically. And thanks to these people at UBC, my supervisor Vesna Salsi in the PET group, and the people at the Pacific Parkinson's Research Center as well.
Yeah. Hi, I have two questions.
Okay.
If you go to the last graph that you showed us, what is the x-axis UPDRS?
Right. So what that is, it's the United Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale. So that basically when Parkinson patients go to the clinic, a neurologist assess them. So how bad are your shakes right now? You know, can you move well? So if I tell you to walk on a straight line, can you keep your balance or not? So then you rank how well do they do? Do they do well? Do they do bad? So this person has a high score, which means that they do bad in a lot of things. They can't control their movements very well. So that means that the disease has progressed a lot for them. So it's a way of measuring how far along in the disease they are. So this is clinical, right? So this is clinical, and this is something that we just measure from our data. So it's nice to see that there's a correlation, you know, in this method that we've derived for it. Yeah. You had two questions.
Yeah. So if you go even back more.
Sorry, I did.
Or probably it's not necessary, I'll just say it. So at some point you compare two images of human body. One is for one is for before chemotherapy and one is for after. Yeah. And you said there, and we see a great concentration of glucose in the upper body.
Yeah.
Why would it be in the upper body?
Oh, it just depended on the kind of cancer that they had.
It was cancer.
I can't remember if it was cancer or if it was tumor, but it was somewhere up in this region. So it's just where the cancer was. I think it was cancer.
Okay.
So,
thank you.